Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Laszlo Bock. Laszlo is the Chief Executive Officer of Humu, an organization that he co-founded with two fellow former Google executives. Humu employs behavioral change science to create better work experiences for employees. Their nudge engine technology transforms organizations at scale using small, personal steps based on science, machine learning, and as he notes, a little bit of love. In his role as CEO, Laszlo brings to bear many of the innovative practices that he developed during his 10-year tenure as the Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google. Laszlo is the best-selling author of the book Work Rules and was named the Human Resources Executive of the Year by HR Resources Magazine in 2010. In this interview, Laszlo describes the genesis, development, and deployment of nudges, which were created to address the problem that, unfortunately, a great number of people are miserable in their jobs. Nudges are digital reminders that prompt the small actions that are most impactful when driving five factors: organizational performance, retention, individual happiness, inclusion, and innovation. In addition to using the product themselves, Humu targets large organizations as customers in order to make the greatest impact towards their mission and to ensure that they are developing products around data sets that are representative of the general population of workers. We also discuss the values that Laszlo draws upon from his time at Google, why he believes analytics, statistics, and computer science will drive a revolution in human resources, and how immigrants, such as Laszlo himself, are fundamentally entrepreneurial in character. Laszlo Bock, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Laszlo, I thought we'd begin with your company. A little more than 2 years ago, you founded an organization called Humu after nearly 11 years with Google as the Senior Vice President of People Operations there. As your own site says, Humu drives behavioral change with the power of people science, machine learning, and love. And I wonder if you could take a moment and describe the business.
Sure. So our fundamental belief is that people are complicated, intensely complicated, and it's incredibly difficult, whether you're a small organization or particularly at scale when you have tens or hundreds of thousands of employees, to have a manager expected to know exactly what the right thing to do at the right time to make their team effective. Or similarly, for me as an individual in a large organization, to know what's going to drive the company forward and what's going to make me happiest from day to day. So Humu is a behavioral change technology company. And what we do is we help organizations transform at scale using something called nudges. And these nudges are based on people science and machine learning and a little bit of love. But the underlying idea is we believe in empowered work. There's too much conversation about engaging employees, exciting employees. We actually believe you need to empower individuals, empower teams, and put the individual at the center of efforts to drive company performance and their own happiness. And so that's what we do.
And talk a bit about how these nudges that you refer to, how do they work?
So the way the nudges work is we start by focusing on metrics that matter. What factors are going to matter most when driving five factors: organizational performance, retention, individual happiness, inclusion, and innovation. And we calculate what behaviors each person needs to change to maximize those factors for themselves, for the team, for the organization. What we then do is we send AI-driven nudges, so small reminders, small notes, tips that can go by email, they can go by text message, they can go by Slack or Yammer, however people communicate, that show up at just the right time to help people be a little bit better or try something new or make their environment a little more inclusive. And it turns out when you do that, what you see is that people take action on the things they ought to be doing about 250% more frequently than when they don't. You see massive improvements in productivity and people are just happier.
And what was the genesis of the idea? How did the idea of both the factors that you just described that the nudges are hoping to facilitate, that they do in fact facilitate, but also just the process of the combination of the technology as well as the interpersonal methods that are necessary here, how did that occur to you?
Well, first, it wasn't just me. I've got two amazing co-founders, Wayne Crosby, who's a technical genius and an amazing people leader, and Dr. Jessica Wisdom, who runs people science for us and actually did her original work when she was getting a PhD at Carnegie Mellon on helping people make better food and nutrition decisions. So it was a team effort coming up with it. But the underlying genesis of this was that two things. One is work's pretty miserable for most people. There's 4 billion people on the planet, and for most of them, work's just a means to an end. It's a grind. You're not treated well. You're not thought of well. And there's got to be a way to make it better. So that was one. There's got to be a better answer. The second was, you know, I've been fortunate enough to work at some pretty large companies like General Electric, which was kind of renowned for its leadership practices and its people development practices. Obviously, I was at Google for a long time and helped shape and build that company. I was at smaller companies too. And what I realized is if you want to drive performance and happiness at scale, there's only a few mechanisms. One is build Crotonville, giant leadership academy like GE had, but it's fabulously expensive. And it tends not to work over time when you have significant leadership changes and investment changes. The second is invest in training and coaching. So, you know, if 10% of your company are coaches, people are going to get a lot better. That's also really expensive. The third is there's got to be a technology solution. There's got to be a way to do this. And behavioral science had evolved enough, and we've been able to push it quite a bit in my old job, and benefit from folks like Dick Saller and Cass Sunstein, who coined the phrase nudge. Folks like Adam Grant at Wharton, who's helped us a bit, and all these wonderful academics. And we realized that there's actually a technology solution to helping people be more aware of how they can learn and grow and make the experience of work better. And that's where the idea of nudging people came from.
And how does the organization drink its own champagne? Can you give some examples of how you're using these nudges internally?
Sure, absolutely. So, we use our Humu survey internally. And so the way the product works is there's a diagnostic. We take in a bunch of different sources of data. Some of it looks and feels like an employee survey, but we also look at productivity data, retention data, and it's very customized for each organization. We then report out. So the first step is we crunch all the numbers. We figure out what matters the most. The second step is we believe in transparency. If people know what's going on around them, they're going to perform better. They're going to be more committed, and it's just kind of the right thing to do. So results get shared. There's conversations about all these things. And then our nudge engine, which is the set of algorithms that powers our nudges, starts firing off nudges inside the company. So for example, I got one this week about, because I'm a manager at our company, about making sure I provide constructive feedback to people on the team. And so I've already this week, I got it on Monday. I already yesterday to two different people made sure that I checked in with them, how are they doing, and gave them specific constructive feedback on things that had happened that week or the week before. And it's because I was reminded that this is the thing that's going to matter most to the people around me. So of all the different management practices I could do, this is what I should be doing. And what's beautiful is you get immediate feedback. You'll say, actually, that was really helpful. Thank you. I hadn't thought about that. Because they're also getting nudged to ask me for feedback. And together we kind of move the company forward.
And who are the early adopters of this? And a related question, what function within companies tends to be the target executive?
So we very deliberately focused on large companies, and we generally have taken a practice of not sharing the company names of who we work with. But what I will say is, so some that have been publicly discussed are Sweetgreen. They were very early on. There's another large tech company that sort of infamously had a really bad culture that has since turned around that we've been working with. There's another company that we started talking about publicly with their permission is Fidelity. And Fidelity is more typical of the kind of organizations we work with. 50,000 people, it's a great company. Nothing's wrong, nothing's broken. But their question was, how do we take it to the next level? How do we become more innovative, more inclusive, and how do we make a great company even greater? And that's more typical of the company profile we work with, sort of large companies that, you know, either are, in Fidelity's case, great and want to get better, but also large companies that, you know, are pushing an agile agenda or transformation or sort of want to somehow be different than the way they are.
And why the focus on larger organizations? And by definition, I have to imagine that means erring on the side of digital immigrants as opposed to digital natives as companies anyway.
Yeah, well, so the focus on larger one is twofold. One is we really want to affect as many people as possible and do as much good as we can. And so you start with larger organizations. Another example is Teach for America, which is a customer of ours that we've been working with, right? Large organization, important space. So we're having impact. But the other reason is one of the traps that HR tech companies fall into is it's very easy to get lots and lots of small startups to try your product because there's a kind of, if I scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's also easy to get lots of individual users using kind of a freemium model where you just push it out to individuals and say, hey, try this for your team. The problem with that is if you start with small companies in the tech industries, they're very homogenous, not just in terms of diversity, but in terms of job type. So you end up building a data set that doesn't apply to most of humanity. And if you want to serve the most people, you actually need to work with the widest variety of people. You also earlier asked about where sort of our partners are coming from. Thus far, it's been almost entirely inbound, and it's about two-thirds from the CHRO, the head of HR, and actually about one-third has been from either the CIO, the CTO, sometimes the COO, and sometimes the CEO. But it's been really interesting. Some of the largest partners we've had have come from companies that are doing a digital transformation that have then said, like, okay, we've got new technology. Now we need to convince 80,000 people or 20,000 or 10,000 people how to use it and how to think in a more agile, creative, transformational way. And so we actually get quite a bit of interest and activity from companies from the IT technology side of the house.
You I mentioned earlier, and you have as well, that you had a long and illustrious time at Google, a tenure at Google. And I wonder what you drew from that experience in forming your own company and what sorts of new aspects you've brought to this culture.
What we tried to do was kind of take the best of what we had there and port it over. So, Google, when I was there, the culture was very much rooted in, mission and transparency and voice. And so we talked about related terms here about being transparent and giving people voice and empowering people. And we've tried to kind of push it and evolve it. So voice is great. Speaking up is great. But empowerment, where everyone actually feels like an owner, is an active participant in how we make decisions at the company, that's much more powerful. The other thing we've been able to do is kind of push further and take stronger positions on things. So, it was, for better or worse, it's been great to be able to weigh in on things like, topics like sexual harassment, where, my very strong view is if there's a whiff of bad behavior, you fire the person. And, when it's our own company, we have the freedom to kind of make those kinds of decisions and weigh in more vocally. It's also been wonderful, actually, to build from scratch and kind of build incredible kind of diversity and breadth into the company. And on the converse, it's a lot more responsibility because, even though I had a big fancy executive job, Google's been fine since I left and Google was fine before I got there. Here, there's a tremendous responsibility that I personally feel and my co-founders feel, Wayne and Jesse, around the individuals who are here and making sure they're cared for, but also for the people we're serving very directly, because it's really important we make work better, and it's way too easy using technology to inadvertently make it worse.
You led a function in HR at Google that is not necessarily deemed as strategic as it should be in a lot of organizations, oftentimes thought of as sort of a support organization of sorts, when in fact the work that it's doing is arguably in some cases the most important, bringing in new people, evaluating the talent of those that are already there, providing the mechanisms to continue to motivate great people to stay for the long term, and so on. I mean, you were a famous HR executive, and there aren't that many famous CHROs, partially because you wrote a fantastic book in Work Rules. Of course, you were the CHRO and doing incredibly innovative things at a company like Google. But I wonder if you can reflect a bit on the evolution of HR and where you see it going.
Sure. I think HR is poised to have the same revolution that operations and manufacturing had literally 100 years ago with Frederick Taylor, that marketing had in the 70s with Time Inc. and targeted marketing, and then with Google and Facebook with like digital advertising, that there's an opportunity to bring analytics and science and statistics and computer science into the HR field. And companies are sort of dipping their toes into it by, trying to start up companies' product here and there. And it's kind of fraught with peril because there's a lot of vaporware, there's a lot of misrepresentation. So you have to be really thoughtful about making sure who you partner with is backed by real science, real computer science, that the data privacy is done right. So there's all these pitfalls, but that's the opportunity. Because if you step back a level, the two biggest capital expenditures, the two of the biggest spend categories for corporations today are technology and people. And technology is pretty well instrumented. There's a lot documented about how to make that more efficient and how to get value out of it. People are not that well instrumented. And one of the things we've been really excited about at Humu is that you can actually sort of build an early warning system for your culture. You can drive performance and behavior across your company. You can have massive transformations in how people are feeling and therefore how they perform and how long they stick around and how inclusive they are by applying the right technology. So that's the opportunity. And, you know, taking from Google, I built with the team this thing called People Analytics, which is bringing science to what we do. And what we're doing now is kind of the next evolution, which is the union of all that cutting edge science that, as you kindly mentioned, you know, I wrote about in Work Rules, but combining that with the best computer science and machine learning on the planet, backed by this tremendous sense of ethics and privacy and treating people right. So that's the opportunity in the HR space to really bring all those things together. And yeah, you don't have to do it with my company. There's lots of great ways to do it. But that would be what I would hope to see and what I think we will see evolving over the next 5-10 years in the field.
Hmm. Laszlo, you were an immigrant to the United States. You were born in Romania, and you are a part of an enormous club of Silicon Valley founders who were born outside of the U.S. And I wonder if you could take a brief reflection on that journey and what makes the U.S. a special place to realize one's dreams. I mean, on the one hand, I think what's important and often lost, especially for those who may have sort of a fear of immigration, is the immigrant's journey is itself fundamentally entrepreneurial in terms of taking risk, doing so with optimism, hoping that on the other end of this crazy journey, there's going to be a better life and some sort of better contribution personally and for one's broader tribe, a family or a company, as the case may be. And I wonder if you can reflect on that yourself as somebody who's walked both journeys, both as an immigrant as well as an entrepreneur.
Thank you. I appreciate the question. I can't think of a better note to end on for this conversation. So as you said, born in communist Romania, my father's first memory, my dad was born in 1941. His first memory was of hearing on Voice of America, the radio station, "The Americans are coming, the Americans are coming." So the idea of America has always been incredibly powerful in my family's life, but also I think in just about everyone around the world's life. This country stands for something, for freedom of the press, for freedom of association, for individual liberty, for a better way of thinking about the human condition. The people who come to this country come for that. I know somebody who's a housekeeper, and she came to the United States from Guatemala. And the reason she left was because she was a principal, and her husband was murdered. And she feared for her life, and she took her kids and came to the United States and applied for refugee status. I talked to an Uber driver who was from Iran, and he came to the United States because he was fleeing persecution, and he had this incredible story about his, you know, the house his family lived in being bombed and destroyed. And Uber was a way for him to make a buck so he could also get a degree in architecture and kind of better himself. To leave everything behind, wherever you come from, whether it's as a refugee or whether it's just to come directly and try to find work, is a tremendous act of courage. It's really hard. Like, just imagine, you know, whoever listens to this, like, saying, okay, I'm not going to talk to anybody I grew up with, going to leave my network behind. I'm going to move someplace where I don't speak the language at all, and I'm going to try to find a way to make it. And I think that drive, the combination of the idea of what this country stands for, plus that drive to make a better world, to make a better life, to build something, to better oneself, is a big part of the reason why you see so many Silicon Valley companies and so many companies founded by immigrants. I mean, lots of people can and should start companies, but the people who've come here are sort of this pre-screened, and I don't mean legally pre-screened, I mean based on what they are putting themselves through, pre-screened set of people who are driven and entrepreneurial and want to build something. And it breaks my heart when I see, you know, that segment of people disparaged, and it's an incredible source of inspiration to see literally trillions of dollars of value, hundreds of thousands of jobs having been created by the folks who were here before me. And, you know, if I'm lucky and blessed enough, I'll be able to, you know, follow in the footsteps of my dad who started a company and my mom who started a company and employed lots of people and maybe do a little good along the way.
That's great. Well, as you say, a great way to end the conversation, Laszlo. Thank you so much for taking time, talking a bit about your entrepreneurial journey, your broader journey, more generally speaking. It's been a great conversation.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Sarah Goa, a general partner at Greylock Ventures.